We're here today to work on a simulation history project. Today is May 20th, 2013. We're on the campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. We're going to interview today the simulation pioneer, Mr. Julian Reitmond. Being interviewed by myself, Robert G. Sargent. This history video of Mr. Julian Reitmond is being produced by funding from the National Science Foundation. And the video is for the simulation archive located at the North Carolina State University Libraries. Julian Reitmond is an engineer who enthusiastically used and promoted the use of simulation for solving complex problems. He was one of the founders of the simulation community as we know it today, a real simulation pioneer. Julian was one of the first individuals to use IBM's general purpose simulation system, commonly known as GPSS. He and the simulation group he established at the Norton Division of United Aircraft Corporation served numerous complex problems using GPSS in the 1960s and 1970s. They also performed research to extend the capabilities of GPSS and developed GPSS Norton, which contained these capabilities. Mr. Reitmond is one of the founders in 1967 of what is now the Winter Simulation Conference. He taught simulation, and in 1971 wrote one of the first textbooks on simulation. Mr. Reitmond was also one of the founders of the IEEE Systems Man and Cybernetics group. He also published the first article in simulation in any IEEE publication in 1974. Mr. Reitmond received the first Lifetime Professional Achievement Award given by the Informed Simulation Society in 1998. Judy Reitmond was active in the simulation community during his entire professional career, especially promoting the applications of simulation. Julie, you suggested that I asked you why this history video interview of you is being done at the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center. Please tell us why.
Well, you have to be lucky in life. 25 years ago, I was attacked with lymphoma, and the chemotherapy radiation worked, and I had a remission of 25 years. However, lymphoma is not necessarily benign, and it decided to come back with an aggressive, and so one of the few places in the country that can treat something as aggressive as mine is here at NIH. So they have been taking very good care of me.
And you're on your way to recovery, as I understand it.
Absolutely. Hope to be home by the end of the week.
Well, everybody else hopes that's true, and we wish you well in your future that they have cured it for hopefully another 25 years.
Yes, right.
Yes, very good. Well, let us now turn to the real purpose of this interview, and that is, what was your first experiences as an engineer?
Well, that's an interesting question because it goes all the way back to what kind of a kid I was. I was born in New York City. My parents were secular Jews. Came the Depression. Dad thought there might be a future in California. So I spent 8.5 years in California getting my education, becoming a sort of a California kid. And I discovered that the smart boys were all into radio. And I was not into radio because I was not going to stay up all night. So lo and behold, I was an oddball. But just before Pearl Harbor, we moved back east, and I liked chemistry. That seemed like a good field. And then I got a job in a chem lab and discovered that chemicals smelled. So I sort of scratched that as a way to go. And then, once the war started, I worked, while I was still in high school, as a tool crib boy in a night shift in a tool and die shop. So I began to learn a little bit about machine tools, how things worked, and so on. But being 17 when I graduated high school, it had not occurred to me to enlist in the Navy or the Army. So being in New York, I started City College in January of 43. Now, having ignored chemical and mechanical engineering. This was a period of the popularity of Nikola Tesla. So I thought, okay, utilities, electricity. That's as much as I knew. But in 43, I had spring, summer, and fall semesters. So I had a year and a half of equivalent of engineering school before I got drafted. And in that period, I took the test for the Navy. The Navy didn't think they wanted me. I took the test for the Army. The Army said, okay, we'll take you. And that was the Army STP program. But when I reported for induction, they told me that I could volunteer for flight training. Well, you know, 18-year-old, what do you know? Nothing. So I took the test. Of course, the test for a college sophomore was not very hard. The interesting thing about the test was that I flunked the part on code. I could not copy code accurately. So that is very interesting foreboding. Anyway, went down to Greensboro, North Carolina for our induction. And this was basically a period of heavy casualties in the 8th Air Force. And they needed gunners like crazy. So they took a whole bunch of New England boys, brought them down to Greensboro, tested them, and flunked them, and sent them to gunnery school. Now, of that squadron, I was probably one of 10 who survived. But the Air Force, and it's brilliant, the Army Air Force, had only about 75,000 more candidates for pilot school or navigator school than they had slots. So they offered me the choice of, you know, tail gunner, ball gunner, you know, all these nice things, knowing that I could not carry code, knowing that I was sent to code school. Now, this is the turning point of my career, code school, U.S. Army Air Force. You sit there, you copy code, but the other half of the time, you learn radio theory. And learning radio theory, I learned there was something that could be called automatic volume control. You could use vacuum tubes and get rid of those balls that the steam engine was spinning. And I decided electronics was my future. But of course, not being able to copy code meant my future was not going to be as a radio operator on a B-17. So I ended up at radio mechanics school. Now here it's a fun deal. You're already got a year and a half of engineering. You got most of the course because they taught it. And all you got to learn is the specific radios that you might have to fix in the field. So graduating number one was a very difficult task.
Well, now you told us about your military experience. Why don't you move into your first couple jobs you did when you left the military?
Well, leaving the military was a very interesting proposition. Here I'd been in radio, in the radar school, was really a sophisticated young man. And lo and behold, what was the Air Corps going to do with me when the war was over? They did not need radar people. They had more radios than they knew what to do with. So they made me an aviation cadet all over again and discharged me for the convenience of the government. So in January 46, I'm back at City College, back in EE. And it's great. I'm having a good time. It's hard work. Engineering school is, as you know, tough. But you've been to it. And then in the fall of 47, I thought engineering jobs might be tough. And since I was taking classes at night anyway, I figured I'd look for a day job. And I got my first day job as an engineer. This was in an electroacoustics house. We made electroacoustic devices. And for the training of a young engineer, the real place to train them is on the test line. Because when the test equipment fails, the whole production stops and you are in yogurt. So, and the ladies on the production floor were just merciless whenever the equipment failed. So that was my introduction to double E, mechanical, drafting, electrical, and the introduction to electrical dynamics. You build a electromechanical, speaker, but you can substitute for the wood, capacitors, inductors, and make an electrical analog, so you can sort of predict the frequency response of that piece of it. And so this introduced me to that simulation using analogies is a very strong method. Now, I'd stated that until the Korean War. When the Korean War came, there were lots of jobs for people in the defense engineering. And the job I got was working with an analog computer. So I learned all the troubles with a real-time analog computer, because it did what it wanted, not what I wanted. And I also worked with very high-performance servo theory. So here I was doing things that were really advanced and not having much success at all. Pardon me.
So on that job, you also got introduced to design digital circuitry, did you? Or did that come later?
Not yet. It came later. Yeah, what happened next is I went to work for North American Philips. And the key thing at Philips that I was working on was we had Geiger counters that detected what happened when you had a lot of nuclear radiation. But we were interested in specific elements in the blast. And so we had to go ahead and separate within the Geiger counter its different aspects. And therefore you had to count them. So this meant you had to learn digital programming. You had to go ahead and make your registers, make your counters, and so on. And that was my introduction to digital circuitry. Not in the sense of designing big computers, but in trying to figure out how do we get this thing to work.
Very good. So then in 1955, you joined Teleregister Corporation as a systems engineer.
Right.
And this is where you learned about discrete event simulation, or you moved to that field. So tell us about that, would you please?
Well, Teleregister was providing airline reservations data to many carriers. And being systems analysts, we knew the problem was peak traffic. When things are normal, everybody's happy. But then comes an event, and everybody gets on the telephone at the same time, or the communication line at the same time, and you got a peak traffic. Now, the question for the system engineer, and this is telephony, this goes back to the Bell system, and actually the Europeans worked on this in the 20s. But what you find is you have a prediction of what is the peak rate of data that you're going to have to handle. Well, we studied queuing theory. Why not? And we made our estimates, and we built the machine, and we installed the machine. And knowing when peak traffic would be, we went down to watch the machine. Now, the machine was very unfriendly. It had not been designed to deal with peak traffic. It had been designed on the basis that every transaction was mathematically independent. Now, the real world, as you know, is not very independent. It has many, many friends who march in consort. So here I am expecting one activity coming in over the teletype line, and there are five coming, bang, bang, bang. Well, the result is you go back home with your tail behind your legs, wondering, what do I do now, coach? And we had a strong team at Dollar Register, very competent mathematicians, systems designers, circuitry people, and we decided to attack the problem. And we went in to look at what can you do with Monte Carlo simulation with a 650. And the answer was, within the financial resources, the Teleregister, not much. But we learned all the things that didn't work. And that was quite a long list. So this is 1958. And I have learned a lot about simulation, why it doesn't work, why it's hopeless, and how it's not going to be a field of any success in the near future. Now, I left Teleregister in 61, and I went to the Norden division of United Technology. It was then United Aircraft. And at Norden, I was sort of farmed out to the systems group in East Hartford. They had the Weather Bureau 433L program to design a weather system that was online. That meant that a pilot waiting to take off in a jet for some far place could actually get current weather data. That was really beyond the state of the art. However, the staffing was a bunch of IBMers who left IBM Sage and thought of the whole program in terms of round robin. You ask and you wait and so on. Now, coming from Teleregister, or I remembered the peak traffic of five times what I wanted, I know that I wasn't going to get there with a round robin. So the question was, how do we get a crew of engineers to think alike? And so we went ahead and set up a tour. We went first, well, we looked at all the big manufacturers. So we went to RCA in Camden, went to Philco in Philadelphia, to Burroughs, to
Univac? Do you go to
Univac? Univac first, yeah. No. Yeah. And then we went out to the West Coast, GE, and finally Minneapolis.
CDC? Data. Minneapolis, who do you see?
Control Data.
Oh, Control Data.
We may have also seen Univac in St. Paul, but my memory is not clear on that. But we also saw Teleregister in Stanford. So by this time, we had set up an itinerary that enabled us to meet the captain of the walk, IBM. So IBM knew what we were doing. We had been forthright with them. And so they invited us to a big one-day celebration in Poughkeepsie. And it was, you know, very much IBM, you know, nice presentation and everything. And whenever a question came up as to how this and that communicated, they said, no problem, we simulated it. Now, remember, I had been burned. Remember, I knew the hardware. And I was not convinced that any simulation would prove that those two pieces would communicate in that time frame. So I asked the IBM rep, is it possible to tell us about the simulator? And he said, no, it's company proprietary.
And what was the name of that simulator?
Well, we'll get to that.
All right.
So I said, you know, from an information content, we've gone about as far as we can go. So why don't you see what IBM wants to do, and we'll find out what the simulator's like. And a few weeks later, they announced that they would host us, about 20 of us, at a hotel in Hartford for a discussion of the Gordon simulator, Jeff Gordon simulator. And that sounded like a good deal. Of the people that went to that briefing, several of them continued in simulation for only a short period of time. These were United Aircraft people, Ham Standard, Pratt & Whitney, but also insurance people from Hartford. So it was a lot of people. The result was we now knew that there was a Gordon simulator, and IBM was prepared to release it. And so at the Fall Joint Computer Conference in Washington, Jeff made his presentation of the Gordon simulator.
Well, for this meeting, you were just referring to the October 1961 meeting. You prepared some questions, didn't you, or something?
I prepared a list of 13 questions.
Yes, to learn about whether that was a good simulator or not, so.
Well, remember, I had been burned.
Yes, so tell us about what you learned about the Gordon simulator and your questions.
Well, the questions went fairly nicely. Checked one, checked two, checked three. Eventually, I checked 12. And I didn't check 13. And it took about 2 years before item 13 was filled in. But it did, and it worked. And that, of course, made GPSS so much stronger than the original version.
And GPSS stands for the General Purpose System Simulation.
Right.
System, yes.
Yeah. And now Jeff is an interesting character. Jeff's an Englishman, double E, and he and I both had experience with analog computers. So we both like to think in terms of real, you know, being active, not waiting for things to come back and so on. See, so he looked at it from the point of view of time. How does the event move in time? And he started off at Bell Labs. And Bell Labs said, we have queuing theory. We don't need your blocks. Goodbye. IBM said, well, we don't know what you're doing, but since we got so much time and money, we'll let you do it. But as soon as the simulator got loose, Jeff got sidetracked. He later taught a simulation, but he did not pursue it as actively as he could have. But he was great to talk to and so on. And I'll discuss later some of our philosophical differences.
Okay, so now Norton was able to get IBM's GPSS software. And so why don't you tell us about some of your projects, a couple of your projects you did with this software, because you're a big enthusiastic guy of solving these complex problems, so let's see whether this helped you or not.
Well, I thought this had a lot of potential. So I went to the Norton management and said, I'll run a course in-house, 1 hour in-house time, 1 hour after, and teach guys how to use GPSS. And lo and behold, we made some models. We learned a bunch of things. And one of the ones I made was a very strange model. Norton made radars, and the radars were on the Navy aircraft, and very often the radars failed, given the complexity of them. And the question was, how many spares did you need to get the radar back in service after it failed? And I ran the model, and the model said it took 3 spares. Now that's counter to the conventional reliability, wisdom, and so on. So one of the fellas had just gotten back off a carrier. And I said, hey, Ernie, I ran this model. what do you think of it? And he starts laughing. I said, what's so funny? He says, well, we had the radar, and the radar had failed. We pulled the module, we pulled from stock the substitute. The substitute didn't work. We pulled the second substitute, and the tow truck ran over it.
So that's why you needed three, huh?
So that's why you needed three. So I realized I had gained insight to a problem that I didn't know existed. So here I was using GPSS, not to solve a problem, but try and figure out what I didn't know about the problem. And that was rather fascinating. There was also an occasion when we were looking into a maintenance area, and there were two groups of engineers, and we built a model, and neither group would sign to it. They each wanted the other way. So here you had the engineers, would not compromise. So you had a lot of fun like that.
Well, you established a group while you were there.
Well,
so
yes.
Why don't you tell us about how you proceed to establish your group and get working on all these problems that you had so much fun with for 20 years?
Well, Norden was a supplier of radars and equipment to both the Coast Guard and the Navy. The Coast Guard was interested if certain maintenance practices could change and improve. And so we simulated that. It showed no improvement. There was some Norden equipment on submarines that we were looking at, whether we could make it better with certain, and those models really didn't do much. But as we were talking, we got in touch with the fellows at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. There was still a Brooklyn Navy Yard, and they had the job of coming up with the requirements for a small naval, a frigate. Now, we didn't know any of that, but they had to come up with what are the requirements for all the major systems aboard this ship. And they were very said, if you can build the model, we'll pay you for it. So we started looking into this and immediately realized the database of a small naval vessel is pretty large, much larger than the version of GPSS that was available. So we went to our good friends at IBM and we asked them, is it possible for you to modify GPSS so we could handle this problem? And they said, well, we're very sympathetic, but remember, software is bundled. We don't see any reason to do this. But if you want to do it, we'll give you all the help you want. So that meant that we now had the problem. We knew the solution. The question is how to go about it. So we went ahead and we put in a proposal to the Navy. We also put in a request for some money from Norden. And with that, we established a team to modify IBM's GPSS so that it could handle models of huge size, which is big. And we then proceeded to work on this a ship model. The beauty of the ship model was we had nothing but data. We didn't know what the different modules did. We just knew we had this kind of data and that kind of data. We ran the model. And the thing that we had done at this point is, in addition to our expansion of GPSS, we had enabled our display unit, IBM 2250, to show us how the model was running in real time. So when it came to debugging GPSS, we were right there. Yeah, you know, yap. The bugs disappeared.
So that was sort of like a conversational or interactive capability.
Interactive capability, yeah. And that's a real breakthrough, because that meant that...
So now we have two new innovative things. One was the memory, and the other was the interactive mode of debugging programs, yes. Yeah.
And that meant that we were productivity way to hell high. So we could really turn out models that worked. And we could change them quickly.
You could change the parameters, right?
Right.
So that was another capability of that.
Right.
Change the model parameters, run experiments.
Right.
Yes.
Now, the fun part of this is the Navy did not want us to know anything about the ship. So they delivered boxes and boxes of cars, which were labeled as to where they go. And those were the data for the model.
Okay, let's clarify that, because modern day computers don't have that. In your time frame, things were put in by punch cards, and you had batch operations until you got your interactive capability. And so computer technology was very different
in
that time era than what people watching this video may be familiar with.
And not only that, they let us have the machine from midnight till 6 a.m.
That means the mainframe you had from 6 a.m. You had the computer, because you don't have the little individual computers we have today. You had a great big
room.
We had
the mainframe, right.
Yes.
And the core memory and all of that. So the Navy delivered the boxes. They then found a place to sleep. Then we punched out all the reports as boxes. And they then took them back to Brooklyn, where they printed them. But we never knew what the ship was, and we never knew what any of them. So it was a very interesting experience. And a couple of years later, somebody on Long Island asked me to talk about it.
Well, also part of your group there, you got into animation. You know, you're talking about internal thing, but you also added animation in the output of the
app.
So how'd that come about?
Norden was in a very strong position because we had a very capable group of simulation experts. United Aircraft did not. And so the people at the System Center in United Aircraft were not happy that we could solve these problems. So you have a political going on that's not easy to deal with. But United Aircraft is very much interested in air traffic control. Because, you know, Pratt & Whitney, HAM standards, and so on. So there was a question of how do you show in the model different aspects of air traffic control? Primarily approach control in terms of landing and so on. So we decided, since we had all the data, why not just go ahead and show it as a dynamic plot? And therefore, you can actually see the various aircraft come in, the runway, and so on and so forth.
So that's another capability your group, simulation group at the company developed. So you were developing some very innovative computer solutions for simulation.
Well, we had
computer technology was not there, but you were pushing the frontiers of computer technology.
We were pushing that computer simulation was a practical tool. Practical. Not theoretical. Practical. So that's where we were. And we felt that there was a big open area where this could be useful. And, of course, an IBM 2250 is an expensive toy.
Well, so you played and developed a lot of these capabilities. Then you turned your group, proceeded to develop GPSS Norton that included these capabilities. So could you tell about that process, about bringing the software language out so other people could use the capabilities you developed?
Remember, IBM still bundled the software. So we were very much interested in letting these capabilities loose. So we arranged that as we made the things available, we would let people use it. It's simple. And there were, I'd say probably overall, we may have sent out 100 copies of GPSS Norden. Maybe more, I don't know. That's not my area.
Well, you had fun building the models and doing the research and let somebody else become the salesman.
Right. Yeah. Well, having succeeded in popularizing GPSS, both the IBM version and the Norton version, we felt that it would be nice to have a community of users. We felt that it'd be nice that we could talk to other people. We were not invited to the major simulation conferences. There was one on the West Coast we weren't invited to. There was one IBM ran that we weren't invited to. So obviously, people who were using it were not going to be invited to conferences. Only people who were designing new ones. So I'm trying to think of the first GPSS focused, mission that I was on. And I think it was to a share meeting, but whether it was Toronto, Montreal, Chicago, San Francisco, I don't know, Boston, you know. What I do remember is in 65 was the World Conference on language, computer languages. And Tokar came over from England with his small book on the art of simulation.
Tokar from England. He's from England,
yeah. And Phil Kiviat was going to be there. I don't know who he was representing at the time, but he was going to be there. He was from RAND. And if there was any discussion of simulation, I never found it. So that was that. So that was 65. Now, there had been share meetings during this period, and they had not really indicated much. 66, we finally had a meeting at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Jack Lubin organized a simulation thing. And we prepared, bunch of us at Norton, a model to show the practicality of simulation. And the conference was a terrible one from our point of view. All it was my approach to simulation is better than your approach. Not that I've done anything. So practitioners were sort of left out. And I was rather annoyed at that. And this is 66. Philadelphia. And then there was a share meeting, I think, in the spring of 67. And I met Harold Hickson, or I already knew Harold, because Harold was the shared GPS simulation. Now, this then brings in Arne Joachim, because IBM had designed Arne Joachim to push GPSS. And Arne had a good deal with Harold Hickson. So Harold and Arne and I sort of got to thinking about this. Now, this is the spring of 67. And you don't think you can do much in the spring of 67. But Arne said, let me see what hotels are available in New York. And so there was a brand new Hilton going up. And they offered a very good price. Well, that sounded pretty good. So the question was, how can we find out what to do? How do you work? Because my decision clearly was you couldn't rely on share to be the sponsor. You had to have a sponsorship by a group of societies. And this sort of is a funny story. because in 1946, when I went back to City College, I joined the Institute of Radio Engineers as a student and kept up my membership, because in the 40s, when I worked in Manhattan, my boss paid for dinner if I went to a meeting. So, you know, why not take advantage? And I went to a lot of IRE meetings. Then moved to Westchester and then to Connecticut. Along the line, I had met a bunch of IRE guys. And there were a bunch of us who, for some reason, were interested in systems. And we would meet usually after work and talk about how you design a system, how you know it's risk, things like that. Of course, we had no leverage, that was that. But we were thinking about it. And in that period, I get a letter from IRE asking me to join and become a senior member. Well, I'm a systems guy and so on. Sure, look what I do. And back comes the rejection saying, you don't have any patents, you don't teach, you don't qualify.
Well, IRE, people may not know what IRE.
Institute of Radio Engineers.
Yes, so just put it on record, yes.
So anyway, that insulted me to no degree. And I wrote a very nasty letter pointing out that system designers rarely get anything to work, let alone be paid for. And within a couple of weeks, my membership was as a senior member. But there was the merger of IRE with AIEEE. AIEEE was old, established, and they were concerned with risk, stability, all of that. And so the question was, what IRE cohort could join the AIEEE guys? And lo and behold, my name came up, and I went to a conference at Case Western and discovered, hey, the world is full of guys like me. So we had a great time, and I learned a lot about some ways to think about systems, other ways not to. And of course, a lot of nice war stories came out of that. But the key thing was I got to know, since we were trying to establish a new IEEE group, Systems Man and Cybernetics, which meant merging a lot of loose ends. And so it meant trying to negotiate with headquarters. And Stamford, Norwalk, were not far from Grand Central. So I got to meet some of the people at IEEE headquarters. And one fellow, when I explained the problem of how we can broaden this share thought outfit, said, well, let me think about it. This is Dick Emerson, who was key guy at IEEE headquarters. And he then proceeded to give me the list of names to call. Out of that list of names, about two-thirds said sure. So that's how we broadened the sponsorship the first year.
So the title of the conference for 1967 was the Conference on the Applications of Simulation Using GPSS.
Right.
And so then, so you got some sponsorship for this conference in New York City at the Hilton. And
but remember, GPSS was already available from UNIVAC. I think it was available from Philco. I know it was being worked on by National Cash Register. So you had at least four versions out. So you could make a legitimate claim that it was no longer IBM.
Yes. So your conference was a success. So why don't we tell us how successful it was?
Well, before we get to that, the real fun was ACM. ACM had no money. And they were not going to go ahead and loan us any money. So it was real fun. The negotiations finally came down that they would give us a check and we would give them a check, and the numbers were the same.
So anyway, go ahead. You were program chair.
I was program chair, which was, you know, I already knew a lot of people. I'd been to a lot of places. So I called Norden, who was very supportive. We got a lot of people, and we were able to appeal because we were being practitioners. This is not theory. This is practice. This works. This doesn't. And it was a very neat deal. We had officially 401 people show up. I don't know that that number is accurate. Here you realize that we're dealing with the year 1967. We have no organization. We have SHARE. We have IEEE. We have Arnie O'Kane pushing from IBM. How do you build a conference with such limited resources? And this was where the luck came in, that Dick Emerson knew how to help us stitch together this sort of thing. Also, he managed to figure out how we could put a budget together. The key thing in all of this was, can you get a budget? Because if you can get the budget approved, you got a chance. And it was fun. So the conference was at the Hilton. We decided never to go back to the Hilton because the ceilings were too low. And the people in the back couldn't see anything. So that was it. There was a luncheon that was included in the fees. And Jeff Gordon and I discussed our philosophical differences there. Jeff's philosophy was that GPSS is so simple, so easy, that every engineer should be able to use it. And I felt that for the type of problems where it is in fact being used, the level of complexity of modeling requires a skill in modeling. And that is the difference between us. I never convinced Jeff, he never convinced me. Basically, trivial models are trivial. They don't help much. You get into GPSS when you're forced to. You look at this alternative, that alternative, and you got to make choices.
So you had a successful 67, then you decided to run a 1968 conference.
Well, that was natural, you know. Somebody had to do it. Harold was done, so it was my turn.
So Harold was the general chairman.
In 67.
67. So you become the general chairman in 68. And so, got any comments on you?
Well,
proceedings. You didn't have proceedings in the first one. Now you got proceedings in the second one.
Well,
so.
a lot of changes. First place, we had a foundation. Secondly, we decided to open up an education track, which is, you know, very important. Also, we got papers on how you know what's the validity of things. So all of a sudden, we're being much more pragmatic.
Well, you changed the name, too. You had just on the applications. You didn't have GPSS
well,
and
the that's because name. The SimScript guys were busy screaming.
Oh, the SimScript guys didn't like that, huh?
They didn't like that at all. But the conference switched to the Roosevelt Hotel, which had nice high ceilings. And we had about 700 attendees. So it was a huge success. Success both in terms of proceedings, in terms of getting all these new ideas opened up, and so on. And I felt that I had contributed a great deal to starting something. And of course, for the next year, Arnie O'Kane took over as general chair, and things kept going. And of course, it's shocking to realize that it's still going.
Yes, well, in 1971, it was changed the title of the Winter Simulation Conference, as you point out. It's almost 50 years now, so what you started has had a long life, and we hope it continues to live for a long time in the future. But the basic ideas you started out with and it grew there. So you served on the board of directors of the Winter Simulation Conference for a number of years and provided your guidance. So other things you might want to say about the Winter Simulation, what led to the Winter Simulation Conference?
The thing that's interesting inside and looking back is all of the founders, all of the guys were not academic. And when you look at the Winter Simulation Conference for the last 40 years, starting with Joe Sussman, they're all academic.
But the nature of the conference still has a very large percentage of
practitioners'
papers. Yes. Yes. So the basic layout you got going in the second or third conference where you had educational tracks, some academic-oriented papers, but still a large percentage on applications.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And the thing is, the conference runs about 1,000 attendees a year. And I think that's a noble service in today's life. How many conferences have lasted 40 years with 1,000 people still showing up?
And the other thing was very unique and still is unique is it's multiple society run.
Right. Yep.
And I think maybe one other thing is run by volunteers. Nobody's paid to run these conferences.
That's right.
And so the model you set up, you know, evolved over a couple of years, has lasted for many, many years. So your concept had to be great. It continues to live.
But remember, this was the pioneers wandering in the desert.
But they headed in the right direction. And that's what's counted.
Yes.
Well, let's change our direction just a little bit. I know you published several papers on your publication, and in the fifth annual simulation symposium in 1972, your paper received the Best Paper Award. So what was that paper about, and what's some of the other papers you want to mention that you published?
Well, the basic point was that you wanted to create an environment for the practical engineer that helped him solve his problem. So you wanted to be able to handle any size model, handle it so that it could be developed relatively quickly. Not an emphasis on speed, because the labor cost of making a model is high, but also on the dynamics, being able to visualize what the model is showing, because it's important that you know what's going on. And very often, the model is so complicated, you don't know quite why this guy interfered with that guy, which made this crash. Now, after the crash, you can go back, but very often, crashes are very infrequent. So you may have bugs in there a long time.
Hmm. Well, also, you wrote in 1974, it's reported, whether it's true or not, I didn't verify, but the first paper on simulation in IEEE publication. So what publication was that, and can you comment on that?
All I remember was there was an IEEE publication that claimed to go to everybody. And I pointed out that they had never had an article on simulation. And they said they never were going to. So it took about 3 years of negotiation.
And which publication was this?
I don't remember.
Oh, you don't remember System Man and Cybernetics or IEEE Proceedings?
No, the Systems Man and Cybernetics. There was plenty of stuff because I was in 69, I was the chair.
Yeah.
So I had an editorial.
Okay, well, let's see what else you did here. I see that you taught many courses on simulation and GPSS within Norton and elsewhere. So.
Oh, yeah.
Will you tell us about, you mentioned earlier on that you had a one-hour course in GPSS, but you taught more than that.
So. Oh, yeah, no. The typical one was you'd go to a Navy base and run a four-day course and see that the guys could make their own models. And we did a lot of different Navy bases. Oh, the other thing that Jim may mention with GPSSH, the longevity of GPSS models.
Why don't you just comment on that then?
Back in 19, 1975, the Navy Air wanted a model of the availability of aircraft aboard a carrier. And the question is, how do you repair, resupply, and so on? This is 1975. So one of the fellows at Norden was assigned to build this model. And he painstakingly built the model. And when he had a problem, he'd ask the Navy, and they'd send him aboard the carrier, and he'd see how the problem was solved. And then he put it in the model. And this kept going on. And it's interesting that that model has never been really publicized, because that model shows how the Navy operated the carrier, not what the Navy regulations said should be operated. And the model kept getting changed. And I think Jim knows how many years the model was active. But it's one model that probably, with modifications, changes, lasted more than 25 years.
That's amazing to have a language to even support it in 25 years and a computer system it can run on. Well, let's get back to your teaching. As a result of your teaching in 1971, you published a book called Computer Simulation Applications, Discrete Event Simulation for Synthesis Analysis of Complex Systems. This is one of the earliest books in simulation. Tell us how this book had come about and why you wrote it.
Well, the reason I wrote it was there was an awful lot of theory going on about how to make a simulation language, different criteria and so on. And not recognizing that, well, in setting up systems and then in cybernetics, I got to meet Hal Chestnut, who was the editor for Wiley of their book on systems. And so he suggested, since you know about these points on simulation, why don't you write the book? And he arranged for me to meet with the editor, Wiley, who was very helpful. And therefore, the book was not directed academically, but the book was directed practically. And the shocking thing I discovered is that it's had worldwide acceptance in that period because of an applications book, not a theory book.
Well, something you should be proud of in your age today, that you look back and wrote a book that was widely accepted in the world. And
yeah, in the world. Yeah, it took me a long time to realize that.
As you sort of alluded to earlier, you were one of the founders of the IEEE, which was the merger of IRE and AEEE, and you formed the group, the Systems Man and Cybernetics Group. So could you describe, you know, your role and how this came about, that you were one of the founders of that
well,
group that still continues and
yeah,
a very
yeah,
important
yeah,
group today?
Yeah, SMC is a strong group. It's very academic today. Lots and lots of papers that you can't understand. It's typical IEEE publication. Good for dissertations and so on. AIEEE had the systems group. IRE had man-machine interactions, which was not medical, but having to do with how you deal with back and forth. So those were the two. Cybernetics was a pain because nobody knew what it was, and therefore nobody wanted it. So as part of the compromise, they decided that Systems Men and Cybernetics would be the new group in IEEE. And I was on the ADCOM and then became the chair, and then the next year we were finally recognized as a full-fledged group. And it's been going strong since.
Well, that's something you should look back on your career to be proud of also, to establish not only the winter simulation, but also a group that survived this many years and growing and strong.
Well, remember, you have a lot of energy. You can do a lot.
Yes. Well, let's see, you're also involved with editorial work with journals. You were a busy young man in those days, and so can you tell us a little bit about your work on journals?
Well, I reviewed a lot of papers. I was a harsh reviewer. I thought that a lot of stuff didn't need to be published.
All right, well, you served on the IEEE press board. You're associate editor for the System Man and Cybernetics Journal, so you were busy doing that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So who were the major people that influenced you in your work?
At Norden, there was one senior engineer who thought very well of systems, and he was somebody you could go to and talk to and sort of resolve issues. So there was that one fellow. At Teleregister, I was very fortunate because we had a tight group of people who understood each other, and that was great. So we worked very well there. Otherwise, there were some IEEE guys who really contributed a lot to the thinking. Bill Linville at Stanford was one such thinker and broadened your mind and so on. Unfortunately, he died very young. The other thing is, you've got to recognize that engineering is incremental. You pick something up here, you pick something up there. Sometimes you modify it, sometimes you build on it. But it's incremental. There's no giant step. It's small steps.
Well, you've mentioned Harold Chestnut. I think you interacted with him, so you must enjoy him.
Well, he was one level above, you know. Harold was... He was much more, you know, into servo theory and things like that.
So looking back over your long professional career, what part of your work do you regard as having had the greatest impact?
Well, I think the in terms of impact, in terms of setting the stage, it was a 67 conference. Because it really splintered off something new that before... was not really feasible.
What surprises did you have in your professional work, negative and positive? Did you have any surprises in your professional career?
Oh, yeah. The major surprise is if you realistically price a system, it never gets built.
So being an industrial people that went out and had to submit proposals, that's had to be an interesting challenge then for you. So what do you believe your legacy will be?
That's an interesting question. I don't tend to think about legacies. I feel I'm lucky to have lasted this long, have enjoyed life this much, have enjoyed my family, have enjoyed the lots of fun I've had. Teaching a variety of courses that are not engineering. So, you know, swim with the pie, with the tide.
Well, you were the first individual to receive the Lifetime Professional Achievement Award from the Inform Simulation Society. Could you tell us about that award and other honors that you may have received?
Well, it comes as a surprise. So all these things come as a surprise. I feel that if people recognize you did something, good. But that's up to them, not up to me. I feel that we were very fortunate in so many of the things we did that they worked. There's, you know, when you look at it, there are a lot of cases that things don't work.
You also received in the 40th anniversary conference of the Winter Simulation Conference, a Best Paper Awards. What was that paper about?
Well, that was summarized the features of the Norden GPSS dynamic, expanded whole thing. All of the pieces were there.
In your retirement, you worked on the documenting the history of technology. Make a couple comments on that, please.
Well, the one that's really fun is in 1904, they made a movie of people working in the Westinghouse factories in Pittsburgh. So here you have a 1904 movie. And in the movie, you see women working. And when you see the description of the movie, not of the actual film, but they point out that women don't work hard like that.
So you had fun. How many of these, you made some videos or something of this work?
Oh, yeah.
How many videos did you make there? You remember?
Just turned them out,
hmm? All right. Well, you had a good time in your retirement doing that, I gather.
But one of the fun ones is we showed one of these videos to a bunch of elementary school kids. And one of the kids looks at it and says, "Boy, I better shape up if I have to work like that."
Where do you see the field of simulation going in the future?
Right now, it's a very disappointing time. We recognize climate change is here. We recognize the models are accurate. And we recognize the public is totally uneducated. Failure.
So that's selling the models, but what you're saying in technology, we can do develop models of complex systems, but nobody will listen to the model builders. Is that your communication?
Yep.
Is there anything else you'd like to discuss for this history video of you?
Well, I thought I'd sort of confine it to what I think was a really fundamental effort to have a bunch of practical engineers go out of their cocoon and come up with something that has a lasting significance. Not a typical path for engineers.
Well, if somebody was entering the field of simulation today, what would you tell them?
Learn politics. It's not what the simulation shows, it's how do you market it. The world is not rational right now.
So they need to be a political animal as well as a technical animal. So
we've got to be more political. I mean, things are just, you just can't believe that people are so blind to reality.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to comment on, or are we?
I think it's been fun.
Okay. Well, thanks for allowing or providing this discussion. Your distinguished career to be recorded. It's going to be very interesting historically to look at your lifetime work, and I hope you enjoy looking back on your distinguished career. So, thank you.
Not only that, I hope there'll be some interesting comments.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.